You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2012 Toronto Fraternal Gathering. The speaker is Brother Mark Vincent, and this is the first address in his series, Things Done Twice, God's Hand in the Life of Joseph. And this address is entitled, The Dreamer, and was recorded on April 6, 2012.
Well, good afternoon, brothers and sisters. I happened to mention to my boss at work that I was going to Canada to give some talks about Joseph, and he began to sing. Now, I don't know about you, I don't know whether bosses in Canada sing to their employees, but certainly not in Scotland, and not when I was in the US either would my boss have done that. But he began to sing these words a long time ago in the land of Canaan, not long after the Bible began, and you realize, of course, that he's singing the words from Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice's Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat. And if that were not enough, I was on the plane yesterday, sat next to a lady who turned out to be one of the soloists from the Anglican whatever it is on Church Street in Toronto, and she also began to sing when I'd said that I happened to be talking on Joseph this weekend. So that musical, which was first performed in 1969, has obviously made its mark, hasn't it? In the world. Joseph is a well-known story, perhaps second only to the events of the life of our Lord Jesus Christ in people's awareness of the Bible. I actually went onto the Joseph website. You can buy a Joseph glow pen and a camel cuddly toy. So it's all there. And the musical has been performed in something like 20,000 schools across the world. So Joseph is very familiar then, even in the world around us, which generally doesn't know very much about the Bible. So how much more is it familiar to us as brothers and sisters in Christ? Well, of course, it's very familiar from our earliest days. Those of us who've been brought up in Sunday school will know the story like the back of our hand. Now, it's always difficult when you're studying or talking about narratives in the Bible that we know so well, because you sort of think, well, what can I say that's not been said before? Not, of course, I mean, sometimes things need saying again, don't they, even though they have been said before, so, you know, it's fine, a bit of repetition is fine, but embarking on the study of Joseph, you do feel very conscious of the struggle that it's going to be to find something that you've not thought before. At least that's how I thought it was going to be when I started my studies of Joseph maybe a year, 2 years ago. And I was amazed by what I found. And one of the things that was and is striking is simply the artistry with which the record is written. And I just want to take one example of that, and it's from the event. You remember when the brothers go down into Egypt to get food, and they leave Egypt behind and they find their money in their sacks, and then they go back to their father and they eat the food, and then they realize they're going to have to go back down again, which is a bit awkward. And they do that, and then they come back again. And Joseph insists that they take Benjamin with them. And Jacob doesn't want to let Benjamin go. And so Reuben says, slay my two sons, I pray thee, if I don't bring Benjamin back to you again. And Jacob's not very interested in that idea. And if you think about it, it was rather a foolish sort of idea, wasn't it? And Reuben speaks with a certain rashness there, which is perhaps characteristic of him. I mean, Joseph, as far as Jacob knew, Joseph was dead. He faced the very real possibility of losing Benjamin, if Benjamin is now to go into Egypt. And Reuben says, well, slay my two sons. Like, that's really going to help, isn't it? We've already got two lost sons, and now Reuben's offering to, well, let's lose these two as well. You can have those two. It's not going to help Reuben to kill his two sons. And Jacob just sweeps that offer aside and says, don't be ridiculous. That's not going to help. Let's just have a look at that. It's at the end of chapter 42. Chapter 42 and verse 37. And Reuben spake unto his father, saying, Slay my two sons, if I bring him not to thee. Deliver him into my hand, and I will bring him to thee again. And Jacob said, My son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead, and he is left alone. If mischief befall him by the way in which ye go, then shall ye bring down my gray hairs with sorrow to the grave. My son shall not go with you. And he speaks to Reuben as if Reuben isn't even one of his sons, doesn't he? Or one of the brothers. For his brother is dead and he is left alone. But then Judah speaks at the beginning of chapter 43. And this was the example I just wanted to pick out of the artistry of the way in which the narrative is recorded. This is verse 3 now of chapter 43. And Judah spake unto him, saying, The man did solemnly protest unto us, saying, Ye shall not see my face, except your brother be with you. If thou wilt send our brother with us, we will go down and buy thee food. But if thou wilt not send him, we will not go down. For the man said unto us, Ye shall not see my face, except your brother be with you. Now, of course, when you read that in a standard AV Bible, or pretty much any printed Bible like the one I'm using here, it just looks like flat text, doesn't it? But in fact, that little speech of Judah's there is very carefully crafted. Unlike Reuben's speech, which is sort of impetuous and not very well thought through, slay my two sons, Judah's speech is very different. Have a look at it again. The man did solemnly protest unto us, that's the first point, saying, ye shall not see my face, that's the second point, except your brother be with you. That's the third point. And then look at the end, the second half of verse 5. It says, For the man said unto us, first point, Ye shall not see my face, second point, except your brother be with you. It's exactly the same, isn't it? So you've got A, B, C at the start of verse 3, and you've got A, B, C at the end of verse 5. The man said to us, that's the A, You will not see my face, that's the B, except your brother be with you. So, he says that at the beginning of his speech, and he says that at the end of his speech, and he says something else in the middle. Now, what does he say in the middle? Because that's the key thing. Now, often when you get these patterns in the scriptures like that, where you get something which is very patterned, so we've got A, B, C at the beginning and A, B, C at the end, the purpose of that is to draw your attention, to draw the eye to what is in the middle. Just like a picture frame draws your eye towards the picture that's in the frame. So what is it that comes in this frame in Judah's speech? And it's this. If thou wilt send our brother with us, we will go down and buy thee food. But if thou wilt not send him, we will not go down. So it's two if-then statements, isn't it? If you send him, we'll go down. If you won't send him, we will not go down. And you see, that's patterned too. The pattern is very obvious there, isn't it? So that then is the crux of what Judah is saying here. And you might think, well, what's so special about that? What's special about the whole passage is how patterned it is. But the content of what Judah is saying there in the middle is this is all contingent now on Jacob. The future of the whole family, whether the family will be fed, whether the family will have food to eat or not, all depends on Jacob. Will Jacob release his only son that he has left? Will he let go of his son so that the family can be saved? And once we put it in those terms, it's starting to sound messianic now, isn't it? If Jacob is willing to let go of his beloved son, Benjamin, then there is a way. Then there is hope. Then the family can be fed. But if he's not prepared to let go of his beloved son, then there is no way, and there is no hope, and the family will not be fed. And that's what Jacob has to learn, and it's obvious what the typological significance about that is, isn't it? Of the Lord God who gave his only begotten son and was prepared to let him be handed over to those wicked men and crucified and slain. And Judah's speech then highlights to us this principle that Jacob has to learn, that he cannot be in control of everything, that he has to let go, and that that stands for a God, of course, who is in control of everything, but despite the fact that he is in control, is prepared to let men do their worst to his son, so that the world might be saved. So that's just one example of many examples in the story of Joseph where, if we look below the surface of the story that we know so well, there's all kinds of other things going on there which are fascinating and beautiful. Now, I think there's a principle that comes out of that, a sort of principle that's useful for Bible study, and that principle is the text itself gives you the clues of what to focus on. Obviously, the lessons come from the text, don't they? We don't make them up. We talk about lessons from the scriptures because the scriptures tell us this and that. So the more we focus on exactly how they're written, the more the chances are that we'll be drawing the right lessons and the right conclusions. And in that little speech of Judah that we've just taken as an example, we've got this elaborate pattern, and once we spot the pattern, then we can start to say, okay, well, that's pretty to look at. But it's more than just pretty, it's something which is teaching an important spiritual truth. The salvation of the family is not just about what Joseph does, it's not just about what Judah does, it's also about what Jacob has to do in letting go of his son. Now, another way in which we're going to see that repeatedly through these studies, God willing, is in the use of repetition. We're going to find ideas and phrases and words repeated and repeated and repeated. And if we can spot those repetitions and ask ourselves, so what is that about? What's that doing there? Why is this thing being repeated so deliberately? Then we can try and work out what the lessons are from it. Well, before we start at the beginning of the Joseph narrative in chapter 37, I'd like us to just stand back for a few moments and think about the contours of what happens in Joseph's life as a whole. Think about the big picture, the top-down view, if you like, and we're going to do that by thinking what happens at the beginning of Joseph's life and then thinking about what happens at the end of his life and just comparing the two, because there are some interesting similarities and some interesting contrasts. Now, I've got some lovely slides here. They're really good, but unfortunately you can't see them. So I apologize for that. I had a MacBook Air and a wire that attached to a projector, and I got a new MacBook Air and assumed the same wire would work, but of course it doesn't fit. So we may be able to get a solution for later talks, but for this one, we don't have a solution. So this sort of thing, some of these patterns, these are actually easier to see, obviously, on a slide than talking through them, but we'll do the best we can, and maybe they can be put up on a website at some point. So, just think about it for yourselves for a minute. What happens at the beginning of Joseph's life and what happens at the end of his life? Well, at the beginning of his life, there's Joseph with his family, with his brothers, and with his dad. And at the end of his life, there's Joseph with his brothers and with his dad. And in the middle of his life, there's Joseph without his brothers and without his dad. So, very obvious pattern there, isn't there? At the beginning and the end, there is they begin all together, as families usually do, but they end there again. But they end there because they've been through a process in the middle, a process of reconciliation, of separation, of estrangement, and reconciliation. Now, no one likes going through that, do they? It's a mess. It's very unpleasant. But the shape of this story is that that's exactly what happens. We begin in a place, we're estranged, the family splinters apart, terrible things happen, and But somehow, they managed to get it back together again. And at the end, there's Joseph and the brothers and the father all together. Now, that, of course, is quite a general point and an obvious one, but it gets more specific than that. So let's ask ourselves, I wonder how old Joseph was when these events began. Well, we don't need to wonder because it tells us in Genesis 37. And Jacob dwelt in the land wherein his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Joseph. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding his flock with his brethren. So Joseph is 17. And then these events happen and the family split apart and Joseph is separated from his father and his brothers. Now at the end, the brothers come to Joseph in Egypt. And Benjamin comes to Joseph in Egypt. And last of all, Jacob comes to Joseph in Egypt. And they're all together again. And then Jacob lives in Egypt for a certain period of time with Joseph. How long do you think Jacob lives with Joseph in Egypt at the end of the book of Genesis? And the answer is 17 years. Surprise, surprise. Isn't that amazing? It's part of the pattern. 17 years with his dad at the beginning of the book, 17 years with his dad at the end of the book. Well, those are the parallels. Now we're going to think about the differences, and there's quite a lot. Now, we can start very simply at the beginning of the book. Where are we? At the beginning of the story, I mean, the narrative. Where are we? Well, we're in Canaan. At the end of the book, we're in Egypt. So that's a contrast. Let's put that to one side for a second. We note, though, that that's a bit odd, isn't it? Because aren't we supposed to be going in the other direction? You know, we're not supposed to start in Canaan and go to Egypt, are we? We're supposed to start in Egypt and go to Canaan. So that makes us think, well, what's going on there? Something a bit strange there that we need to think about. But we'll just park that and say, well, what other contrasts are there? Well, at the beginning of the book, Joseph is a shepherd. We've just seen him there looking after his father's flock. And at the end of the book, Joseph is not a shepherd. Well, he's a sort of, in a kind of metaphor, he's a shepherd, isn't he? But not of sheep now. Now Joseph is a major political figure. Joseph wields more power in Egyptian politics than anybody else, apart from Pharaoh himself. And Joseph actually takes more of the day-to-day decisions, by the sound of it, than Pharaoh does. So at the end of the narrative, then, Joseph is, well, depends how you think about it. He was in charge of Egyptian economic policy, wasn't he? So he was a kind of chancellor. He was a sort of prime minister to Pharaoh's king. He was a minister of agriculture, if you like. Whatever you want to call it, or he was the grand vizier, whatever term you use. He was a massively important political figure, wasn't he? He began as a shepherd and he became this enormous political figure. We begin with a family scene, a sort of peasant nomad family in this backwater of Canaan, and we end up in the cultural capital of the world at the time, in Egypt, with this political scene and all this finery and grandeur of Egyptian life. So the set, if you like, expands massively, doesn't it? We're in Canaan, but when we get to the end, all the world is the stage. Because Joseph is in charge not just of Egypt, but all the nations are coming now to buy food and provisions from him and to be kept alive from this famine that the world is undergoing. Now, at the beginning of the book, Joseph is a servant, perhaps. Now, the AV puts it like this. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren, and the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. Now, they were probably the least esteemed brothers, weren't they? Because they were the sons of the handmaids. And Joseph was with them. And in fact, some scholars suggest that you should understand that passage like this. Joseph had been a servant boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah. So he was a kind of dog's body. He was their servant. He was the servant of the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah for a while, and then Jacob sort of lifts him out of that and gives him the coat of many colors, and then it seems as though Joseph's at home then while the other brothers go out and do their thing. But Joseph begins then perhaps as this servant boy of the lesser sons, and he ends up with all the other brothers bowing down to him and saying, we are your servants, Joseph. So again, another obvious point of contrast there. At the beginning of the book, Joseph is the second youngest brother. At the end of the book, Joseph is the second most important person in Egypt, isn't he? Pharaoh's number one, and he's number two. And in the meantime, Joseph had been Potiphar's number two, and the keeper of the prison's number two, and then he becomes Pharaoh's number two, but he began as the number two youngest brother. So again, another turning things around, isn't it, God? Turning things upside down, as it were. And finally, we begin with dreams. Dreams of brothers bowing, and sheaves bowing, and suns and moon and stars bowing, and we end with reality, when that actually happens. So that's a lot of aspects, isn't it? And I've got a slide here, of course, that lists them all, but we've walked through them anyhow. This huge set of parallels and contrast between the beginning and the end of the book. And we said, well, okay, so what is that about? Well, it seems to be about there being a pattern to Joseph's life, there being a shape to Joseph's life. Joseph's life is going somewhere. Joseph's life is not a random sequence of events. Now, as we'll see in later parts, in later talks, there were times when Joseph's life must have seemed to him very much a random sequence of events. But we know differently, don't we? Because we can stand back and take this big view and see how it started here. And systematically, all those aspects at the beginning got turned upside down and shaken up and turned the other way at the end of his life. And there was no randomness or accident to it at all. And it was all part of God's wonderful design and purpose that Joseph should save the world. Now, that's quite interesting with respect to our own lives then, because sometimes if it's right that Joseph must have at the very least scratched his head and thought, why is this happening to me? Well, we've probably done that ourselves, and we've probably thought, I have no idea why this should be going on in my life, and why my life should look like this. And it feels such a mess. It doesn't seem to have any shape to it. I thought I was going in a particular direction, and I seem to have lost the plot, or lost my place, or lost my way somehow. And I don't know how to make sense of these things that are happening. And if it's right that Joseph felt like that at some points, as he stood at the end of his life and looked back and remembered his dreams and how that had now become reality, and thought about all those aspects of his life that we walked through at the beginning and how they'd been turned around the other way at the end, and he thought about the 17 years and the 17 years and the number two and the number two, then he would have thought, this is just amazing. This is astonishing. This is God's design. This is God's handiwork. Like taking the microscope and looking at the cellular structure of something, or looking at patterns in nature, so he could do this in a kind of way with his life. And we can do that as readers of the Joseph narrative. And we can see that everything did have its place, and that God knew what he was doing, even though it might have seemed to Joseph at some points that he didn't. And that's the test, whether we can trust God to to be in control of our lives when it feels that we are not. Now, let's come back to this question for a minute or two about why we begin in Canaan and end up in Egypt. Why we seem to be going backwards instead of forwards. And I don't know the answer to that. This is a thought that I've had, and I'd like to share it with you and see what you think about it. Perhaps it's the case that we can say that Jacob and the brothers, and perhaps even Joseph in a way, were not ready to be in Canaan at the start, as they were in Genesis 37. Now, that's easy with the brothers, isn't it? We take the brothers and say, well, look what they did to him, casting him in the pit, stripping him of his coat, and pretending that he'd been devoured by a wild beast and selling him into slavery in Egypt. Doesn't get much worse than that, does it? We can see that they weren't ready to be in the promised land. They've got a lot to learn. So it's fairly easy to deal with them. Then we think about Jacob and think, well, Jacob's got seems to have some issues too, doesn't he? And this favoritism that he shows and the problems that that brings, this inability, going back to that passage we looked at about Judah and his reluctance to let go to help his family, Jacob has some things to learn too about control and wanting to be in control. And having to learn to let God, to allow God to space to work in his life. So Jacob has some things to learn too. And then we think about Joseph. Now Joseph's more tricky, of course, because we're so used to thinking of Joseph as a type of Christ. And once we get past chapter 37, it's Joseph doesn't seem to do anything wrong, does he? So we think, well, if Joseph is such a great type of Christ, then in a way he can't be doing anything wrong in the narrative, can he? We know that he must have been a sinner because everyone was apart from Christ. But, you know, we might like to read the Joseph narrative and find everything that he does to be good to make him into a type of Christ. Now, whether that's right to read the Joseph narrative or not is a separate question. But we might want to read it that way. But perhaps Joseph himself has to develop in a certain way too. And we'll come on to some of the possible evidence for that in a moment. Because he doesn't seem to be, for someone who's going to be a politician. Now we know what politicians have to be, they have to be diplomatic, don't they? They have to have a sense of what to say and what not to say. And how to be nice to people, and how to make people like them, and maybe you didn't need that in Egyptian politics, I don't know. But these skills of diplomacy and tact, Joseph doesn't seem to have a lot of it as he gabbles to his brothers about his dreams and sort of pushes it in their face about the things that he's dreamed, about how they were all going to bow down to him. So, well, maybe that wasn't the smartest thing to do. Maybe it wasn't the best thing to do. And perhaps in order to be the wonderful leader that he was later on in his life, perhaps too he needed to go through an experience to mold him and to shape him for that work. And isn't that a principle by which God works with us as the potter also? That he's fashioning us, and he does it by the knocks and the difficulties, the frustrations that we come across in our lives. Not by everything being just as we'd hoped for, a walk in the park, everything's coming up roses. That life isn't like that, and if it seems to be like that for us, then it probably won't be like that for very long, will it? Something will happen to destabilize us in some way. It usually does, and God is molding and fashioning us. And for that, for this family, they had to go into Egypt. And Egypt becomes for them the furnace, the proving ground. Egypt is what changes them. Egypt is what brings the possibility of reconciliation for the family. Because they weren't united, were they, at the beginning in the Promised Land? They were supposed to be united, but they weren't. And so they had to go through all this in order to get so that they were ready at the end of the book. So perhaps all of them, certainly the brothers and pretty sure Jacob, Joseph's a bit more of an open question perhaps, they needed to have this conversion experience, if you like, this time in Egypt. That's what prepares them, the struggles of Egypt. Well, let's spend our last few minutes looking at one or two of the details of chapter 37. So we found Joseph with his brothers, and you'll see at the end of verse 2 it says that he brought to his father their evil report. So he told tales on them. And I don't know how you read that. Now, of course, it could be that they were doing terrible stuff and that he was right to tell his father, because then his father could have done something and tried to change their ways. That, of course, is the benign reading, the pro-Joseph reading, isn't it? It's ambiguous, this, and that may be the right interpretation. And if we're thinking of Joseph as a type of Christ, it's true that Christ, seeing the wickedness of the scribes and Pharisees around him, he spoke out against it, didn't he? He said it was wrong. He didn't just say, oh, well, yes, don't really like that, but I'm not going to say anything because I don't want to offend anyone. Of course he didn't. He spoke out very clearly about it. And so perhaps Joseph is right to go and tell his father. Maybe he should have told his brothers, actually, which it doesn't say whether he did or not. But the other reading is to say that Joseph was a telltale, a snitch on his brothers. And if you look at the other occurrences of that word report there, it's usually things that are slanderous and negative, and often things that aren't true. Now, the fact that the word is used in that way on other occasions doesn't mean that it has to mean that here, but, you know, it's not helping Joseph out the way that that word is used elsewhere in the scriptures. And also that word report, slander, it's qualified by the word evil as well. So it's as if Genesis is telling you, you know, it's not just bad, it's evil bad sort of thing, evil slander. Be that as it may, whichever way you take that, his father loved him and gave him the coat of many colors. Now, the only other time that expression is used is of David's daughter, and Tamar, and you remember what happened. And there are interesting parallels between that and the Joseph story that we don't have time to go into, but that makes an interesting study. Now, what does it mean, the coat of many colors? Well, the usual explanation is that the word colors there relates to the Arabic word for hand, and so it's a coat that reaches to the hand. It's a long-sleeved coat of some kind. The use in Samuel, or Kings, about Tamar implies that it's a royal garment. It's obviously a garment that is a special coat, isn't it? Of some description that singles out Joseph above his brothers. And of course, they resent him for it. No surprises there. And when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Now, it says twice in those verses that Jacob loved Joseph more than them. And it says three times that his brothers hated him for it. So, I mean, that's interesting, because it's as if the hatred overcomes the love. There's more of the hatred than there is of the love. There's two occurrences of the love and three occurrences of the hatred. And the hatred gets the better of the love, and the love is blind to notice that the hatred is going on. And Jacob is just naive, isn't he? Jacob, who thought himself so shrewd and so able to manipulate and control things, seems to be unaware that this situation is playing out right in front of his nose in his own family. And the favoritism that existed as a problem in Abraham's family and in Jacob's and in Isaac's family now exists in Joseph's family too. And there is a lesson in that, isn't there? That people tend to repeat the same mistakes. And the way that I bring my kids up, what will be my guide for that? Well, hopefully the scriptures, and they are, as much as I try and make them my guide. But I'm also going to be the next most important influence, or an equally important influence, or perhaps even a more important influence, is the way my parents brought me up, isn't it? And when I think about what it means to be a father, my first guide as to what it means to be a father is what my own father was to me. And you can see the mistakes being repeated down these generations. And that's a warning to us to think about that. To think about things in our own families. And, you know, sometimes you say to yourself, and you may have caught yourself saying, as I have, if I ever have kids, then I won't do that. You know, that my parents did to me. Well, I just make other mistakes instead. So sometimes in that sort of resentful kind of way we say that, don't we? Well, I'm sure I'll never do that. But then actually, if we can stand outside ourselves and look, we are actually quite like our parents in various ways. And, you know, my wife can see how I'm like my dad much more easily than I can see it, I suspect. And in many ways, that's good, of course. You know, he's a nice man. But in some ways, it's not so good. So this is something for us to reflect upon, isn't it? And what we need to do then is to be conscious of how we are being, isn't it? To not just sort of go through on autopilot, but to be actually thinking about behaviors that we've seen, that we've been conditioned to in our environment, in our society, in our family, in our ecclesia, and not to just be doing them automatically because that's how it is, but because we've actually thought and think, yeah, that's a good way of doing things, or that isn't actually a good way of doing things, and that there might be a different and a better way. Well, let's just carry on to one other thing here, which is about the dreams. So, verse 5, and Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it to his brethren, and they hated him yet the more. So here's the second of the hatreds now. They hated him yet the more, and there's a little play on words there, because of course Joseph means to add, to make more. So what it says literally is they Josephed hatred to him. They added hatred because Joseph was telling them about these dreams. And he said unto them, here I pray you, this dream that I have dreamed, and there's the sheaves dream, verse 8. And his brethren said to him, shalt thou indeed reign over us? And they hated him the more for his dreams. They Josephed even more hatred for his dreams and for his words. And he dreamed yet another dream. He Josephed a dream now. I mean, it's really laying it on thick here, this passage. He added another dream and said, behold, I have dreamed a dream more. I have Josephed a dream. And behold, the sun and the moon and the stars bowed down to me. Well, when you read through that account that Joseph gives of his two dreams, there's a word that he repeats as he's telling them. I wonder if you can spot what it is. Verse 6, verse 7, verse 9. It's the word behold. And once it's, I think four times it's translated behold, and one time it's translated lo. Behold the stream which I have dreamed. And behold, the sun, moon, and the stars bow down to me. And lo, we were binding sheaves. And behold, your sheaves bowed down to mine. And I think this is Joseph as not being diplomatic, isn't it? This is like the ultimate example of not being diplomatic. The brothers aren't really going to like this dream, Joseph. You might want to be a bit, you might want a soft pedal on this one, but no, he's doing the exact opposite. He's saying, behold, a look, a wow! And you meet people like that, don't you, that almost have like a verbal tick where there's something, and what do you know? And they'll just say that, you know, every few sentences. Or you know, like I just said, you know. And Joseph seems to have this behold tick in his speech in these verses. Look, wow, there it is. And we're going to find that picked up upon later on in the narrative. But In a way, there was no wonder that his brothers didn't like it, was there, when he was telling them like that. Let's just have a quick think about these dreams. So, two dreams that Joseph has, and did you notice the emphasis there in verses 5 and 6? Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it to his brethren, verse 6, and he said, "Hear, I pray you, this dream which I have dreamed." So four occurrences of the word dream in those two verses, and there's another 9, I think, in the rest of the chapter. So a whole load of references to dream, and if we were to go to chapter 41, there are 17 occurrences of the word dream in that chapter. So Joseph is associated with dreams. Joseph and dreams. You can't get away from that association. What's it about? What's the point behind that? I think there is an interesting point, and it revolves around this. As far as I'm aware, there is no example in Genesis of God saying something directly to Joseph. Now, I'm not saying God didn't say anything directly to Joseph. He may well have done. But as far as what the text reveals to us, it doesn't show God saying anything to him. Now, God said plenty to Jacob, and God said plenty to Abraham, didn't he? And he spoke to Isaac too. So there's a clear difference then, there's a clear distinction to be made between how God reveals himself to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the Genesis narrative, and to how he reveals himself to Joseph. Now, why should there be that distinction? Well, because one of the points about Joseph is to show us that God works through providence and the events of life. God doesn't just communicate in words, he communicates in things that happen. And there's perhaps no better example of that in the scriptures than the Joseph narrative. And so it's as if God draws one step back, as it were. Now that's helpful for us because we live in an age, we believe, when God does not speak directly to us, as in tell us things in our ear so that we know whether we should, you know, what we should do when we get up this morning. It's left for our conscience to decide that, isn't it? And our responsibilities. And so the Joseph narrative is helpful to us because this is more like our own age in a way. And by communicating in dreams, in this more shadowy sort of way, where you need to interpret, obviously a dream must be interpreted, so too we have to be interpreters, not only of the scriptures, but of, in a sense, our own lives and the things that are happening, in order that we make decisions and decide whether to proceed like this or whether to proceed like this. So just as Joseph had to be an interpreter of dreams, we too have to be interpreters, not of dreams, but of events that happen in our own lives. And the Joseph story is a kind of training course for us as to how we might do that. So perhaps that might help us towards thinking about how God's way of communication is so different here. Now, I've taken long enough, I think, for that first talk. So let's stop there. And when we come back, we'll talk about what happened next to Joseph and how he was sent down to Egypt.